You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What up, it's Forza Philip on the track, yo. There's a new queen in this game. She go by the name.
Miracle trigger on the stack and casting it. Just like time St. Catherine's happening. Five, 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 fling, think of flashing in. Trying for the truth, we both voracious. Oops, my B, I meant voracious. Honestly, my deck's predacious. My miracles are so salacious. Get your heart in public, ostentatious. 40K, that's Warhammer. In the church of force of fill, they clamor for his deck list. Cause they're so enamored. Cause it mashes like the Brits, that's bangers. A correctly cast predictor plan to kind of balance all your tricks you jam. Determinist, your board, your lands are stranded. I'll throw at your face and then I'll snap a candid. Presidium, protect T. That St. Catherine's flavor feature. Shuffle sick cards right underneath her. She's Ethereum, I'm Tez the Seeker. I'm Botticelli, she's Primavera. I'm Monet, she's Folie Bergère. I'm Renoir, she's Grenoble. I'm Matisse, she's Bernal de Vivre. I'm Goya, she's Tormakia. I'm Van Gogh, she's Mona Lisa. I'm Rembrandt, she's the Thandabera. I'm Dukes on Twitch, she's the Pain Slayer. Warhammer, those were art bars. Like an artist, I draw cards. Illustrator, I'm illustrious. I'm a writer, here's a plot twist. Miracle St. Catherine, like a javelin to the abdomen and the top sedan. She's a deadly sin, she'll string you out like a violin. She's sticky like a goblin on the battlefield. She's residing in, no denying it or defying it. Time to resign the game and sign the slip. She'll beat you down with a cape and shield. She'll steal your life and then make you feel so sad and lonely and so defeated. You'll beg for mercy, wish you'd conceded, but you had your chance. That's in the past. This game was over when it came to pass. Your fate was sealed right from the start when I miracled this work of art. Miracle St. Catherine, by design, she's so sublime. Turning water into wine, she overhauled the archetype. Haters try to deny the hype, but triumph shrugs it off like she's kryptonite. And you're Superman with your stupid plan. She'll make you resign like you're Vince McMahon. She'll make you tap with a sharpshooter. Best there was, best there is. While you're a loser, rock bottom you straight through the basement. She'll stone cold stun you to your grave since she's MTG's new Undertaker. Tombstone you, that's a neck breaker. Triumph's the truth is an understatement. She saw the flare, it's second nature. She's Triple H, she's taking over. She's Dean Malenko with the four-leaf clover. She's bold, weird, intimidator. And you're a coward who can't block her either. She's future sight, unprecedented. You can call her Garrett cause she's relentless. She'll break your teeth, send you to the dentist. You're a partisan, she's an independent. A triumph is a funeral, a procession so beautiful. A lingo's a little unusual, but I'll still outplay you inscrutable. Magic, the gathering is not magic. St. Catherine, the red zone's a labyrinth for your creatures. Inadequate. Miracle St. Catherine, like a javelin to the abdomen and the top sedan. She's a deadly sin, she'll string you out like a violin. She's sticky like a goblin on the battlefield. She's residing in, no denying it or defying it. Time to resign the game and sign the slip. She'll beat you down with a cape and shield. She'll steal your life and then make you feel so sad and lonely and so defeated. You'll beg for mercy, wish you'd conceded, but you had your chance. That's in the past. This game was over when it came to pass. Your fate was sealed right from the start when I miracled this work of art.
There's a new queen in this game. She go by the name. What it do?
Hello and welcome to Eternal Dirtles. I'm your host, Zach Clark, and with me as always, Phil Bleckman. Phil, how's it going, man?
Yo, what's up, Zach? Dude, I have no money. What do I do?
Great question. We've got some budget episodes coming up for people with no money. The very first thing you should do is go to moxfield.com, and you'll be able to look at your budget for your deck as you're building your deck, which is what we've done here. We've got a couple of decks that we're listing. This time, we're going to talk about Artifacts Blue, 8-cast, and some sort of variants around that. But I think for all of these episodes, we kind of have a through line, and that's like, you got to get your staples, right? And once you have your staples, then you can sort of build decks around those staples. With this episode, I think the staples we're going to be talking about are like Ancient Tomb. You got to get your Ancient Tombs. Luckily, that is a card that's not on the reserve list, so it'll be reprinted. And so as soon as they reprint Ancient Tomb, which will happen eventually, snag them up.
They've reprinted Ancient Tomb a couple of times. I mean, hopefully we'll go through a couple of deck lists. And for players that are listening to us, somehow if you found us and you're like, how do I get into Legacy? Hopefully this will be a nice intro episode for you. For people that are Legacy aficionados, I mean, the overhaul of the format, like the churn of the format, something that's happened recently is there's been like the discussion that Ancient Tomb is actually the most powerful card in the format over Brainstorm as the pillars shift because more powerful tools come in. You know, Wed Initiative is the most popular deck in the format now. It's like the winningest deck in the format now. So it's like, is Ancient Tomb actually the new backbone of powerful legacy decks? And there's a swath of legacy decks that use it in conjunction with things like Urza Saga and Chalice of the Void and yada, yada, yada. Hopefully this will be a nice little refresher for the ingratiated legacy folks as to like recognizing which cards are the actual pillars of decks. The decks that use the same pillars of a format are susceptible to the same kind of cards because they use similar tools. Yeah. So it's always helpful for me when I'm trying to figure out like sideboard planning, like how am I actually figuring out sideboard planning? Unless I'm specifically trying to target something very minute, like very micro targeted, like a particular card. If I'm not doing that, I'll usually look at my sideboard mapping and think of it how I'm trying to attack the pillars of the format. So I'll be like, these cards are generically good against Ancient Tomb decks because of the tools that they usually bring in. These are the cards that are good against the blue cantrip style decks that are looking to go a little bit longer. These are good against the Green Sun Zenith decks, which there's a bunch of that are usually, it's either elves or some type of land focused deck that revolves around Green Sun Zenith. Graveyard based decks, right? And like the engines that come out of the graveyard. But usually those are also like Mox Diamond decks or similar. Things like that. So we'll go through a bunch of them.
To start off with, one of the great things about playing a deck that needs Ancient Tomb is that you're not playing Brainstorm, Ponder, and those cantrips. So you're kind of moving away from those. And that also often means that you're not playing dual lands and fetch lands, which means that you're going to get to cut costs right there. You don't have to spend money on 4 Scalding Tarns and 4 Volcanic Islands. And look at that. We've just saved you $10,000, everyone.
Yeah, luckily, so Ancient Tomb's not reserve list. So there are some lists that play solo lands that are on some number of City of Traders. Like, the initiative deck right now is on 4.
And it's Super Saiyan form. It's fully unbudgeted form. It does play one City of Traders.
Yeah, I was playing one City of Traders. So we'll dive into it. The first thing that we'll talk about that as a budget list that's actually competitive is all of the variants of 8-cast. 8-cast is in the game for a little while now. Like, ever since it got Kappa Cannoneer at the early part of 2022, it's been a pretty dominant deck. It's had a bunch of top showings. It's usually pretty good against Elver. It's soft to things like Meltdown. You know, like it's an artifact-based affinity deck, right? It's going to have those kinds of weaknesses. The thing is, though, is that the deck kind of adopted its form as 8-cast and then never really evolved. Like, it got Kappa Cannoneer and then just didn't. And you've been playing 8-cast for what? A year now, right?
Almost a year, yeah.
Yeah. As we were looking at these types of lists and where they kind of situate, the format has shifted dramatically. But 8-cast, for some reason, has just stayed as the deck that it is.
Strong like bull, man.
Without really ever moving too many of its tools. Yeah. And once I approached it as somebody who hadn't, like, you know, I knew what 8-cast was. I knew, like, the play patterns of it. But I never really devoted too much thought into, like, how do we improve this deck? Like, are there different ways that we can position this deck? Once I got into it, I was like, okay, there's very clearly a shell here, right? You have the 8 baubles as your engine. You have Emry, which is just Library of Alexandria and Legacy with those baubles, or with Lotus Petal as a Birds of Paradise. Like, it is your turn one card that does a whole bunch of flexible things with your shell that offers you a lot of power and a lot of flexibility. But the top end otherwise, like the draw twos, the size, the kappas, all of those numbers were always in flux. Like, some people weren't playing all eight casts. Some people were playing 6 to 7 in combinations of the two. Some people weren't playing all 4 Kappa Cannoneer. Some were. Some people weren't maxing out on size. Some were on 2 to 3 Psi. There was a couple of variations in numbers. And when I see variations in numbers like that, I go, there's not a stock build. Like, when you look at Delver, that shit is stock across
pretty
the
much,
board.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same 52 cards, I would say, in almost every Delver list, blue-red Delver list. And then there's,
I would argue that it's the same 70.
Sometimes people want to play Iconoclast over, you know, another threat. Like, it varies very minorly, even when they do vary the cards. It's like, here's another win condition that's 2 mana. It's one of those things. So they don't do that much where they change stuff.
The list that we're going to talk about is one that I played on 90s MTG. I'll play a little bit more of it because I saw that people were interested in it. But essentially, it looked at what is that shell? What is the engine that's going on in 8-cast? And it's the 0 mana artifacts.
Yeah.
If you can exploit the 0 mana artifacts in Urza Saga, which is the backbone of the deck. Urza Saga is its own pillar, by the way. It's like, anytime you're playing Ancient Tomb, you're probably playing Urza Saga, unless you're doing something that ends the game faster. So, for example,
Show and Tell.
Initiative right now, or Show and Tell. Yeah, those decks, they're trying to end the game before you would even finish tutoring off your Urza Saga, right? So you don't need it.
Before we get too far in, speaking of exploiting, Phil, I wanted to make sure that people knew, to comment, like, and subscribe. You know, what are your choice budget decks? Wow. put your lists below, because I always want to look at these budget lists and kind of share them with the community. It's a great way to get people into the format too. But also, anytime you comment, we add your name to a list, and we draw a card out of the MTG Advent calendar, the countdown calendar that we won at Eternal Weekend. And so we give out one to our Patreon supporters, and we give out one to our commenters. So these two are going. We've got, looks like 2010 and 1999 went out this week. So definitely comment, subscribe, like, all that stuff. But commenting is what gets you on this. Subscribing to our Patreon also gets you on this. Can subscribe for as low as a buck. All that goes into helping me and Phil continue making this podcast on a pretty regular basis. And that's kind of it. The other thing I'd want to tell you about is to go to moxfield.com and check out these deck lists that we have. The deck lists are below. Also, you can follow Phil, myself, and the Eternal Dirtles podcast on moxfield.com. Moxfield is a great deck building website, and you should be using it to build your decks on your phone, to build your decks on your PC, on your Mac. You can build for any format. And it's just altogether, it's one of the best deck building websites on the internet, and they sponsor the cast, so you know, go and check it out.
It also lets you choose your printing, and I all of my decks are in the most expensive possible printings, by the way.
When my Phil sent me his Tamishii list, I was like, oh yeah, it's just a budget $12,000 deck, because he's like, I'll play a beta Tundras in here.
Yeah, you gotta get all of the most expensive versions in your Moxfield, since you're not going to do that in person.
One of the beautiful things about building a deck on Moxfield is there's actually a switch printings button, and it says use cheapest. It'll find the cheapest version of that card and switch it to that printing. So you'll know, you'll have a very obvious reflection of what is the lowest you can buy that deck for. Pretty cool tool.
Very useful tool.
So let's talk diving about back this in. Tamishii deck. Let's dive into the Tamishii deck after everybody comments what their favorite budget deck is.
So here's the thing that I want to highlight about this particular Tamishii deck, which is just an example. Like don't read too far into the fact that we're going off of this one. This is just an example of things that you can use to also find additional ways that to potentially budget your deck while still making it competitive, which is just being able to analyze
at your list before I made the changes, right?
For example, this list, it has cut all of the thought cast, and it has all of the cast part of the deck, the draw twos, the generic draw twos, gone.
This is eight bone.
It is maxed out on Kappa Cannoneers, and it is maxed out on Temeshis.
Yep, and we've thrown out the Chalice of the Voids in your list.
Thrown out
as
the
well.
Chalice of the Voids. We are not interested in Chalice in an initiative meta.
I think that's worth mentioning. Is Chalice is still pretty good, but the more Ancient Tomb decks you see, the less good Chalice becomes, because what are you going to do? Put a Chalice on four, or a Chalice on eight. To stop some of these cards?
Before, when you would run into a format where if the two top decks, let's say, are Four Color Control and Delver, and you're like, okay, these are both cantrip decks. Now, by the way, like, similar to how we're talking about how 8-cast, in my view, is an Ancient Tomb Urza Saga bobble deck. Like, that is the shell of the deck. That's where, if you're going to attack the deck, you want to attack that part of the deck. Similar to the Delver and Four Color decks, people would use Chalice to cut off the fact that they are an 8 cantrip deck. They're Brainstorm Ponder plus, Source of Plowshares or Lightning Bolts or whatever. So their impactful stuff that, like, gets them going is on one. And so you would go and just play your Chalice in the dark on one, assuming that it's going to hit the majority of the top decks in the format. Whereas now that Initiative is one of the top decks in the format, you can't reliably, you can't go into an event thinking, okay, I'm going to slam this Chalice on one in the blind against in a meta where 30% of the field is Initiative. You just can't, you can't do that and expect to reasonably do well unless you're winning matchup lottery, which is like, at that point you're gambling. Right.
Yeah.
So
helps that if your entire plan isn't slam Chalice, like, that's why I think 8-cast can get away with continuing to play Chalice, because they are actually using that Chalice for other things, to tap for Kappa Cannoneer and stuff like that. Like, they're getting use out of it in other ways.
So one thing that has been very noticeable over the last couple of years in terms of printings is that they've been extremely favorable for Ancient Tomb. So if we look back before 8-cast fully came into its own and became a blue Chalice deck, and it used to be Urza Echo, and we'll talk about that. And then when Initiative came in, and then white Ancient Tomb decks were starting to take over. It was Red Stompy was the go-to Ancient Tomb Chalice deck. It was Red Stompy for a long time.
Yes.
And the history of Red Stompy is pretty long.
Stuff, man.
It's been a long time for Red Stompy. And a lot of the time, the joke was always that when it comes to Ancient Tomb Chalice decks, you could play whatever you want.
Like, you could win with a ham sandwich.
The top end after you set your lock piece of, you know, your Trinisphere or your Chalice or whatever, after you went Ancient Tomb
your
plus,
Blood Moon,
you know, essentially like those types of decks, Ancient Tomb just, it wants to skip the development stage of the game. So in other games where other people are trying to, you know, develop their mana base or develop their positioning so that they can deploy their threats comfortably, the Ancient Tomb decks just skip that first part of the game. They're looking to get past that early development part of the game so that you don't get to. So the whole point of those decks was to stop your opponent's development because they got to fight on the axis of not needing the development because they were looking to skip over the first, the ones and twos on their curve.
Yep.
So if you could establish that, if you could do that, it never fucking mattered what your top end was. You could play goblins, you could play planeswalkers, you could play random nonsense. It literally did not matter. And every time there would be a new list, it's like, oh, look at this cool new thing. And then you'd be like, oh, it's just an Ancient Tomb Chalice deck. It's whatever on top. It never mattered.
How many
what was
times
on top.
Did we set review? And I'm like, this could go in into a Blood Moon deck.
Go in,
you know,
go
like,
in anything. It doesn't matter. Literally, it wouldn't matter what your other thing was. You had already won the game by that point, and you just needed something to close it.
Yeah.
So the actual way to attack the deck wasn't what was on the top end. You had to shut off the stuff that was effectively winning the game, which was the Ancient Tomb Prisons portion of the deck. The thing is that the printings in recent years for Ancient Tomb decks have gotten so powerful that now all of the cards are good. It doesn't, like, you don't have to play the bad cards on top of the stacks pieces because you're not playing the good cards that the stack pieces are looking to fight. Now you can just skip over that stuff and go into way more powerful effects. All of the cards in Initiative Stompy are good. All of the cards in Red Stompy before Initiative got in became good. They're all banger cards now. You never, like, before you were playing with Chafe, now you're playing with bangers. And because of that, the trajectory of Ancient Tomb's power level has significantly increased over that time. So if anybody's looking to get into a deck, the foundation of those decks are Ancient Tomb. So it's like, if you invest in your Ancient Tombs first, it will open up a wide variety of options for you because all of those options are now viable because the power creep has been so steep. But
and
the thing is that they all come back
the
to the foundation.
Of what one dual land is. That's budget, you know, like being able to be like, well, instead of buying like one tropical island or one tundra or one volcanic island, I'll buy four Ancient Tombs and I'll just play that deck. And then suddenly you've basically cut like $1,000, you know, $2,000 from your deck.
Yeah. That is one example of a pillar of the format. So in this particular case with Temeshi, I'm thinking, okay, what are the powerful parts of this deck? It's the baubles. As I played Acast, I recognized, and tell me if you've recognized the same thing, because you have a lot more experience with Acast than I do. When I played Acast, I realized the most powerful thing that you can be doing is that you're cheating on mana with your card draw through the baubles. And then because Emery comes down on your turn one, and it's what you would like to do every single game, regardless of who you're playing against, I'm like, this is our engine. An Ancient Tomb lets us further push that tempo, if you will, of not spending mana on effects.
I don't want to counter what you're saying, but I will say that especially because we're talking about this Temeshi list, actually the most powerful thing you can do, Phil, is make constructs with your Urza Saga.
Sure. So yes, the Urza Saga shell alongside Ancient Tomb, the fact that Urza Saga gets powered up because you're playing all those baubles, that is your core. Everything else is fluff. And so I was looking and I was thinking the only card that I'd be unwilling to cut from this shell outside of the baubles, the Urza Saga and the Ancient Tombs is specifically Emery. And then your zero mana Mox effects, right? Your Mox Opals that you get off of your Urza Saga. But those are the cards that I'm like, this is the backbone of the deck. It's actually not that, like, it seems like Acast doesn't have a lot of space because you have to play the Acast. And I think that's where, when you look at deck lists, fuck the naming of deck lists. They are so misleading. The deck is not an Acast deck. The fact that it has four Thoughtcast and four Thought Monitor, that's not the powerful part of the deck.
Oh, yeah.
That's the payoff.
Yeah.
And the deck is named after the payoff, not what's actually powerful, which is the engine. Really, this should be, like you said, 8-bauble. Like, it should be called 8-bauble. Or, you know, or something along those lines. That would be more informative as to what the deck is. So when I recognized that Emery was the most powerful thing to be doing, I was like, I just want more Emerys. And the closest thing to an additional Emery is Temeshi. And so I added Temeshi to the deck.
Yeah.
And suddenly now, when I'm playing the deck and people are have to fight over the Emery, it's like, well, now I have 8 Emerys. I'm way more stacked on Emerys. So now I get to do this. The upside of playing the more expensive version of Emery, which is Temeshi, is that Temeshi can rebuy your Urza Saga out of the yard.
That's big. That's so huge.
Here's a unique thing about Urza Saga and why it was a pillar immediately when it came into the format, even though, like, beyond the fact that it is just an egregious design that makes, you know, 60 power off for free and tutor something, like, the card's egregious. But the other unique thing that it has, it is unique in Magic in that is the only zero mana enchantment that exists.
Also, yes.
30 years, the only zero mana enchantment. And that can be exploited. And Temeshi
certainly,
that.
I mean, in two ways, specifically with Temeshi, being able to get it back from the graveyard is great. But even bouncing it back to your hand with
the trigger, you can't do it with the trigger on the stack. It's activated as a sorcery. Activated as a sorcery.
That,
you can't bounce
but
it
that's
back.
Still pretty good. Like, even if you're just doing that every other turn to like make another construct, it's still pretty good.
You can't bounce it with the third lore trigger on the stack.
Of course.
You can make a construct with two, bounce it, and then replay it. That is something that you can do. And you draw a card in the process. The trick though is that there are synergies to this deck that when you look at new cards or cards that could fit into certain homes and you start to see the synergies that work, you're looking for the synergies that often will go with your engine pieces, with the things that make the deck. So the deck revolves around Baubles, Urza Saga, and Ancient Tombs. Emery is exacerbating the power of those cards. And then Temeshi further exacerbates the power of those cards, including with the Emery. So you can flip over, like, if you mill your Urza Saga off your Emery, that sucks. That's one less Urza Saga that you have. But that's actually prime positioning for where Temeshi wants your Urza Saga. Because if you pick up a land and then replay and then pull the Urza Saga out of your yard, you draw a card and you're at mana parity. Picked up the land, but then put another one back into play. And now you're just going to be threatening constructs for the rest of the game until they remove it. And now you're fighting on two axes, right? The reason that Urza Saga is so good is that it gave all of these artifact decks a different axis of attack than like looking for Pain or Grindstone or looking for whatever. Instead of fighting on that one axis where your opponent could disrupt it, now they have to deal with this massive beatdown plan while you're also doing this other thing. It's an incredible card for misdirection. It is what is leveled up a bunch of these decks. Like Painter got leveled up significantly because now it has this insane beatdown plan for free added in.
And now, Phil, I want to talk about some of the choices that are different than 8-cast that are in this deck. One of them being Thran Turbine.
Yeah, so Thran Turbine is a one of. For those who don't know, it's a one mana artifact that says at the beginning of your upkeep, add 2 mana to your mana pool. You can't use it to cast spells. So what you can do is you can use it to make constructs off your Urza Saga. Yep. You can use it to activate your currency converter, which is another tutor piece that you just get to have for free. And the trick though is that was after some testing. What I recognized is that I would put enough Urza Sagas into play that I would be in positions oftentimes where I wouldn't have.
You didn't have enough mana to activate them all, right?
For what it's worth, this goes beyond into like, you know, deck building and discovering this as I was brewing this particular kind of deck that, you know, as other people find new tools for new decks as they're brewing, this is a great time to brew, by the way, because the format is solved. The format is two decks. The format is Initiative and Delver. And if you can go into an event and expect that 60% of the time you're going to be playing one of two decks, that means that if you position a brew that is excellent against those two decks, you're going to be optimizing your chances to like face your best matchups, which is excellent time to brew. It's really difficult to brew in a wide open metagame because you don't know what you're playing against, and your brew in that regard has to be proactive, where now you can brew with all kinds of builds because as long as you're strong against the two top decks, if you're soft to the other stuff, you're taking the calculated risk, but as a smarter calculated risk because the odds are in your favor.
One of the beauties of this deck actually is that it does have a good game against Initiative because of Kappa Cannoneer, and also with 8-cast Psy being able to block and attack with those constructs, you can take the initiative from them.
So another example of the card where every time I was looking at 8-cast and I saw that they were playing 2-kappa or 3-kappa, I'm going, what is going on?
It's a great magic card.
The shell is built to maximize the fact that Canna Cannoneer is broken. Like,
exactly.
Kappa Cannoneer is broken because of the shell. Like, those are the exact cards that you want when you're building this kind of deck. Like, I get that the affinity cards say affinity on them, but like drawing two cards is nowhere near as powerful as killing your opponent in a turn and a half. Kappa Cannoneer is way more busted than those other cards, and there's no reason that we shouldn't be maximizing that card. So it is an easy four of, and again, it's another thing where it similar to how Kappa Cannoneer works with Emery and all of the baubles. Emery puts contracts artifacts into play, which makes it unblockable and kills your opponent faster. Temeshi turbocharges that, right? Temeshi you can only use as a sorcery, and you only draw once per turn off of its effect, but you can use its effect as many times as you want in a turn. So if you have four lands in play that you've been picking up because, you know, you milled your Seat of the Synod, so you got to pick up a land and put that land back into play and then play your land, that's a rampant growth. And as you have more lands in play, once your Kappa Cannoneer has stuck, you can storm out. You can just use your Temeshi to pick up lands, to put artifacts into play, pump your Kappa Cannoneer, and then, you know, it comes in as a 5/5, you could hit for 11 on the following turn, you know?
Well, you can even
by
do
just
that
playing,
with,
by playing your baubles.
You can basically do that with like a Lotus Petal. Or if you have a Mox Opal in play already, you can basically use Temeshi to continue to put the Mox Opal into play, right?
What you can do with Temeshi, which is a really cool trick, is you can sack your Lotus Petal for white. Mm-hmm. It's in the graveyard. then activate Temeshi, bouncing your land, picking up that same Lotus Petal.
Yeah, so it's so just if free. You have lethal on the board with like a couple activations and you just need the enough mana to kill your opponent, you can do that with Temeshi. You just need that number of lands, right?
To reiterate, this isn't just an episode where we're jerking off a new card. Like this is a card that has gone under the radar that works with the inherently powerful shell that's already been proven, which is distinct. We're highlighting Temeshi because it's a prime example that I've been working with, but it's not the only one. There are tools for other decks to do similar things. Another example, just a quick side tangent. Another example of this is the Fiend Artisan decks that like moved away from the combo part of Elves to play Fiend Artisan for a while. Elves recently has moved towards combo because they just need to go under initiative and they want to be faster. And so we've moved back towards Nettle Sentinel. But for a while, when the deck was playing for Fiend Artisan, it started out as a two of, but the pillar of that deck was Green Sun Zenith, right? If you could have 8 Green Sun Zenith, fucking great. That's where it's similar space, right? All of the effects that are powerful in the fact that you have this toolbox, like all of that toolbox is made more powerful if you have more ways to dig into that toolbox. And Fiend Artisan just being Green Sun Zenith on a stick makes total sense from the deck building perspective of how it eventually got to, I just want more of this card. Yeah. Right? Okay, going back to Temeshi.
In any good like deck building like process, you quickly realize like what the best card in a situation is. Like I did that with Vintage when I realized that like I just want to be playing 4 Collector Ulfs. You know, like I was playing 2 for a while and I switched to 4 and I was like, this is every time this card comes down, I win games. You get to a point where you're just like, you just realize that like, if this is what you want to be doing, you need to play the full compact of them.
And that just goes back to like, what's your plan? And anytime somebody's like, my plan is, you know, I want to bury my opponent in cards with all these thought casts. Like, no, you fucking don't. You want to play your bubbles proactively and you want to like accelerate onto the board and then you're burying your opponent. You know, like that's the engine. The engine is not your payoffs. The engine is your engine. It's the argument anytime somebody's like, do we ban the payoff or do we ban the enablers? When you look at initiative right now, yeah, the initiative cards are too powerful. You know why they're too powerful? Because fucking Ancient Tomb exists. That's why they're powerful. The fast mana exists. The cards themselves, if they were actually coming down on the turn that they're supposed to come down, are they powerful in 1v1?
If you cast a Kappa Cannoneer on turn 6, it would be fine.
if you cast any of your initiative creatures on turn 3 or 4 as they're supposed to come down, not turn 1 on the play, would they be powerful? Yes, the initiative is still insanely powerful. Would it be broken calling for potential bans? No, I don't think so. If you have time to develop, then no. The whole point is that Ancient Tomb is skipping over the development portion of the game. Like the fact that initiative hits so hard and so fast is because against the decks that need the time to develop, they are not given that luxury. So, and therefore the format feels way faster. And it's not that it's faster, it's skipping the early game. This is to say that if you have the Ancient Tombs and the Urza Sagas, right? The couple hundred across the table that's gonna cost you. Mishra's Bauble just got reprinted. It's now like quarters.
Yeah.
Same thing with Urza's Baubles, like
Urza's
a couple Baubles bucks.
Like $7.
Cool. Your Emrys have been reprinted into the ground. They're like $2. Temeshi is literally like 50 cents, whatever.
Yeah, it's not even.
Kappa Cannoneers fell off. Like they're like $6-$7. And you don't even need necessarily those cards. You can look into other things that press the advantage of the shell. But once you have the shell, that gives you a little bit more freedom in terms of figuring out what will work within your budget to find cards while still being competitive. Once you have those pillars, you don't need to feel hamstringed by your wallet, because there are enough tools in the format now to be playing decks that aren't, you know, the have to have 4 Underground Sea Doomsday decks to play in the space of competitively viable decks. That's good for the format.
That's a great thing for the format, you know? So I took your deck. Obviously, we removed the sideboard because sideboards shouldn't count towards the budget. Like that's something you're going to have to make a decision for yourself, and also that just adds sort of an arbitrary amount of money to the end of your cost. So I took your budget list at $13,000, and I moved it down to $900, $917. Now I made some concessions, so I want you to kind of tell me how bad you feel about these concessions if you are on a budget. If you look in our budget list here, what I did is I added considering to all the cards that I removed. So they're all on the bottom. You can still see them. And I'll tell you what I changed. So I added Ancient Den to the deck and I removed the Tundra and a couple of City Traders and a couple Ancient Tombs, just because that's a lot of money to start out with. And this kind of gives you a chance to get a feel for the deck. And Ancient Den doesn't cost anything.
I would steer towards literally cut everything else before the shell.
Yes. Right? Yes. Yes, so, I 100% agree. If you already have the ancient tombs, play them.
Like, I see you swapped like Force of Wills for Force of Negations to like bring that money down.
Yeah,
Force of
Will is getting another. That's not great, but it is.
Force of Will is getting another reprint soon, so I imagine that will also bring the thing a little bit down. But it's in the similar space. Like, I would cut literally anything else before I cut the ancient tombs from a deck like this.
I agree with you.
So like, even if you had to play. Even if you played a deck like this, Force of Willless, without forces, I still think that would still be better. Yeah. I think that would be better than cutting any of the ancient tombs from the deck. And part of that is that there are tools in this. There is no trade-off for cutting the shells, right? So if you cut part of the shell, you're not gaining anything other than hindering yourself. So if you cut ancient tombs, you're only hindering the deck in a meaningful way. If you cut anything else from the deck, like let's say you cut Force of Wills, right? Like egregious. How could you cut Force of Wills from a thing? You're a proactive deck, right? There are other tools that you can use to interact with the opponents. It doesn't like Force of Will is good, but it's not mandatory the same way that something like Ancient Tomb for a deck like this is. So if you were to cut the Force of Wills and think, okay, I have, and this is the perfect example, Zach. You're like, I have the Ancient Tombs, I have the Baubles, I have the Moxen, I have everything that I need to for the shell of this 8-cast variant to work. But I can't afford the Force of Wills. What do I do? There are so many options available to you in other targets for Urza Saga or other pieces of interaction that you can use over Force of Will to target the metagame in meaningful ways that you can use those to still be competitively viable until you hit the Force of Wills. Because Force of Will isn't good against everything. There are going to be games where you board Force of Wills out. Like, do you want Force of Wills against Delver when they're bringing on all the red brass? Probably not. Similar things like that. So, for example, this deck in particular, as a means of interaction that I tested, was repeal. I was like, oh, in this format where everybody's on Chrome Moxen and shit, bouncing your Chrome Mox with a repeal is fucking great. You know what else is really good with repeal? Temeshi, which we brought in. Temeshi with repeal is just gush on a Mox, right? You pick up your Mox, you draw a card, you play the Mox, it costs you no mana, you've drawn two cards because repeal drew your card, Temeshi drew your card, and you didn't spend any mana. The other side of it too is that repeal with your zero mana artifacts works with your Kappa Cannoneer. You can storm out a little bit faster. Repeal bounces any of the shit that would otherwise stop you from doing your thing. Like you were talking about Collector Roof. I have four main deck repeal. I'll bounce that, storm out, go ahead, play your thing. I've already gotten underneath it, right? There are options where it's like, is repeal the best thing? Probably not. Like maybe there's things that I wasn't thinking of, but there's space to interact with your opponent. Like the choice of interaction pieces, the interaction pieces in Legacy will never be the foundation of a deck because the interaction pieces changes based on the meta, where the foundation of your deck doesn't change. What your deck does is what your deck does.
So Phil, I made an adjustment with what you said in mind. So I added the four ancient tunes back to the budget list. I removed the Force of Negations. And I added four thought casts.
I get that this is with a constraint, like this is with a budgetary constraint. But I think that this is where, when looking at a creative way around your wallet for decks that are still competitive, this is a deck that if somebody showed this to me, I'd be like, oh, this is a cool 8-cast variant and it wins a tournament. You know what I mean? Like, it would not surprise me because I'm seeing that all of the powerful parts of the deck are still intact. You know what I mean? When it comes to brewing new lists or attacking a format, this is how you can do it without feeling limited by your budget, but doing it in a way that is still smart without hindering what is powerful and viable in Legacy. How smart is it? If you're thinking like, okay, if I don't have Force Will to protect my threats as they come down and I replace those forces with Thoughtcast to power through their counter magic, that's a clever innovation that theoretically will work against the matchups that you would be looking to target with, right? It's clever. Yeah.
So in doing that, the only other like real change is like Mox Opals are expensive. I don't suggest people go and buy like multiple Mox Ambers. They're not great. But if you happen to have some lying around, they switch somewhat in this deck so that you can still get, you need to have at least one Mox Opal because you need to be able to get it with your Urza Saga if you need it and it has to work. But you could play Mox Amber as like a two or three of. I don't love that, but like it does, Mox Opal is an $80 card. Mox Amber is a $30 card.
Another example of when you're brewing decks, talking to the value of talking to people who have done a lot of the work for you before you go in and make deck building decisions and going into an event. When I look at the choice of cutting a Mox Opal here, do I think Mox Opal is part of the powerful shell of the deck? Not necessarily, right? I think it's the Baubles, I think it's the Ancient Tombs, and then you have like your eight or Emrys, if you will, to pay that shit off. But when I know from experience that with Temeshi and the limited amount of white sources, Mox Opal is constantly invaluable because of the fact that it's a white source. Now, is that offset by the fact that you have a couple of Ancient Tombs in the deck where I didn't? It's possible. But I also think that like the value of Mox Opal scales.
Ancient Den.
So like
Ancient Den.
Ancient Den. Sorry, what did I say? Ancient Den. So you have Ancient Den, so you have additional white sources in your deck. But like the value of white sources, particularly to pay off Temeshi, is really important. So Lotus Petal is incredibly important in this deck. Yes. Mox Opal is incredibly important in this deck. More so than what normal 8 cast is, where it only needs one color. So you're only ever really tapping it for blue. Maybe in some people's cases now, they'll tap it for green for Haywire Might, which is really a really minimal splash. Where Temeshi is really part of your engine. If you're cutting those sources, you're hindering the power of a new card that you're using to exacerbate the shell. If you can just know, be aware of that going in, that a lot of the times you're going to be positioning yourself that Urza Saga is going to have to get your Mox Opal out of here. Similar things to think about when you're thinking about your play patterns. Like, it's not going to play out necessarily the same way.
The other big changes I made were like, I took out City of Traders. I added in a Crystal Vein, which is not like ideal, obviously, but you know, when you're trying to get that like turn two play the early play, it does something.
Yeah, I mean, there is still value in the fact it's just ahead, right? So like what I found was when I was playing the City of Traders, which is, you know, an expensive card, the City of Traders wasn't necessary. Like,
yeah, it's not needed. Yeah.
I was like, the Ancient Tombs are necessary. Like, I wouldn't leave home without four of them.
Yes.
But the City of Traders was just another boost of mana that like was available to me because I own one City of Traders and it was valuable and it worked because the play pattern of being able to like play a Mana Crypt and bounce it with Temeshi is like really powerful. So I was like, there's value in that. Whereas Crystal Vein, it won't give you access to that play pattern because you have to sacrifice it. But you know, there's other facets. Like the engine was powerful enough that I was like, there's space to maneuver here. Same thing, like Odawara Soaring City, like it's really powerful to be able to have additional interaction, additional removal spells in your deck that you can comfortably play out. Like I see in the budget list here, you have two copies. I was playing three copies, and three copies sounds like a lot. Like three copies of one of those.
I moved it down to the bottom. I only played two in my 8 cast deck.
The difference, though, is that like Temeshi changes the numbers a bit because it's still another legend, right? Like it's similar to like size spot where it was still a legend. But the difference, though, is that when you in an 8 cast, when you play out your Odawara, it's there. It stays there.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a really good point with Temeshi. Yeah.
Temeshi can pick up your Odawara after you used it as an early land drop. So it gives you that utility late game where you can that's fearlessly good. Throw it in to play, knowing that it's not stuck there. You're not limited on them. You do get to pick it back up later on if you want to. And then not only do you get to pick it up, but then it's also still discounted. Yeah. So you get to effectively use your mana again.
So another adjustment, if you refresh the page, Phil, you'll get to see. Another adjustment I made is I went down one Mox Amber and up one Mox Opal. Because it's like that's like a $60 change, and it didn't change the cost of the deck that much. We're still under $1,000.
What a fantastic look for Mox Field right now, where we can make changes to the deck in real time as we're discussing it.
Well, this that's what's great about the site, you know, is like we're doing this on the fly live, you know, able to do this. And then like the other changes I made were like I removed a Tundra, which, you know, blasphemy, bummer, you had to remove a Tundra from your deck to make it budget. But I threw in those ancient dens to offset that white mana.
I have the Tundra. I was playing Tundra literally as a one of, and I could totally see it just being literally any other blue white land, you know, like it's not unreasonable. The Tundra's there is
you could play Sea
just,
Chrome Coast.
You actually could. Yeah. For real though, you could, because like that's actually a really good idea in that the deck doesn't often hit past its four lands because Temeshi's picking lands up and Urza Saga is going away.
Exactly.
So, and the fact that I'm not fetching the Tundra also means that Seacrum, like there are the corner cases where like you do have a bunch of lands and it could punish you, and therefore I play the Tundra because I have a Tundra and therefore I can. But like if you don't have a Tundra, it would be totally reasonable to just play Seacrum Coast in this build where you're never really getting to four lands too often.
Because Seacrum Coast is getting reprinted too. So you've got this $12 card that will probably become a $3 card.
Dude, that is like when it comes to working on a budget with a deck, like that is an ideal looking consideration, right? Like I'm playing the Tundra, but I'm not fetching it. So the fact that it's an island is not like a fetchable land, not relevant.
I mean, you remember when I was playing, like this was like back when Energy Field, Rest in Peace was a part of the Miracle Shell. I played one Tundra and I didn't have money for another Tundra. So I played a Prairie Stream and it was for the most part pretty fine.
Yeah.
Dude, it wasn't great. Like there's going to be times that I get punished because I can't play my turn one Sensei's Divining Top, but like we're not even living in that world anymore,
dude. And here's the thing, so like you putting like when I get that we've removed Force of Wills here for this thought experiment, and something that is in a similar space as to the thought cast idea that you had of putting it back in, this is where playtesting becomes important. But a card that I've wanted to use with Temeshi since I started brewing with it was I was like, oh man, maybe Temeshi in a shell like this is finally where Mystic Remora can be powerful, because you can put it into play to like effectively
and then bounce it so you don't have to pay the age counters. Yeah, that's smart. Well,
you don't pay, you let it just die because the Temeshi can just pick it back up and reset the counters. So if you want, you could just play it, and then if your opponent's not doing anything, you can deploy while you're playing your zeros with your ancient tombs to like pay for the mana offline or whatever to keep it going, to pay for the cumulative upkeep for a couple turns.
It's in the deck.
Have them add a bunch of
one other ancient den. It's in the deck now.
Like have them give you a bunch of cards additionally, which you're going to be able to play out those cards because you're you have 20 zero drops in your deck, and then like if it goes away, you just get to rebuy it with Temeshi and do it again, and now reload. And now anytime they're one for one in you, it's fucking great, right? Just another example of the space that opens up that otherwise regular eight casts wouldn't have had, but that is possible because the shell remains intact. Like the only cards that I would look at to change are the cards outside of the shell that the shell is enabling, not changing any of the cards in the shell. I would never look to change the baubles. I would never look to remove the ancient tombs. I wouldn't touch the Urza Sagas. I would change any of the pieces that Urza Saga is getting. I would change some of the interaction pieces. I would change some of the payoffs that you're getting, such as Thoughtcast versus Mystic Remora. But the repeals can be sourced to Plowshares if you wanted. But the actual shell itself, that's staying intact. And because that is intact, that is a legacy viable, powerful shell that will give you wins just because it's good. The other stuff on top, it'll work in different matchups. But the shell remains. And this is and it's under a K. You know.
Yeah, I'm at 58 cards on the budget 8 cast list right now, and I'm trying to figure out like what would I add if I took out the Force of Negations for this list.
And this is a good starting point. And this is an example of even if you don't have all of the tools that would make it optimized beyond the fact that like there's options like your Sea Chrome Coast could be a Tundra, et cetera, like aside from those minimal things, like I think the 4 Mox Opal would actually make a significant difference, right? Like that actually would up the power level of the deck of just being able to have faster starts. And it's like if it's just out of range, it's also good to know that those tools within the shell are the next pieces to get once you do have the budget. So once you've established and committed to getting a shell like this, the additional tools on that's where like those are the first things to move towards, as opposed to like the Seachrome Coast versus a Tundra, that's really negligible. But having 4 Mox Opal versus 2 Mox Opal, that's noticeable. And it's helpful to know where to prioritize advancing the deck once you actually do save up.
Yeah, I'll work on the 8 cast version. I have Temeshis in there right now, but I think I'm going to take up Temeshis and make the more traditional 8 cast version that's like a budget list as well, and I'm going to post that too. But I think I think this was a great thought experiment where we get to see exactly like how building on a budget kind of works, and it always helps, like obviously always helps to have somebody else to bounce these ideas off of while you're doing it. And this was a perfect example of how this should work, and I think the episode works well because of that.
And I would suggest that anytime, if anybody ever shows you a deck, like if you go to your Moxfield account and you share a deck list with somebody, and somebody's going to look at the deck and then immediately try and tell you what doesn't read well to them, they're going to go, this doesn't make sense to me, right? And then even if you explain it, if they haven't actually played with it, they're not necessarily going to see eye to eye on the choice that you're making. But what can be helpful in those situations is, as long as the conversation is revolving, or as long as both people having the discussion about trying to improve it in a deck and bounce ideas off each other, as long as we both have a mutual foundation as an understanding of what the legacy power level thing in the deck is, then the other stuff on top, then we can start talking about how those interact with different matchups and how we care about certain matchups that, you may prioritize another matchup over one that I do. And so therefore we have different ideas on what would be good in this slot. But like, as long as we have a mutual understanding as to what the foundation and engine point of the deck is that shouldn't change, then we get to go, okay, if you make a suggestion, and I go, well, that doesn't read to me, you can go, well, I'm thinking about it this way because of the fact that the deck works like this, which is the engine. This works well with that engine and pays it off against these matchups. And having that kind of conversation about a particular card is a much better way.
It's big brain magic stuff. Yeah.
In my experience, it's a much better way to like isolate the power level of a card in a deck than just being like, this is just better. This is the better card. And it's like, that doesn't mean anything.
Well, it's all about putting it into context, of course.
It's all about context. And the context is that foundation of the deck. And if you can look at any deck, whether it's 8 cast, whether it's Miracles, whether it's 4 color control, whether it's Delver, if you can look at any of those decks and say, what is the powerful thing going on here? And how can we exploit that with our top end off the shell? That's where you can optimize things. It's like in a Delver deck, if somebody recommends a 3-drop, you go, why would you ever play a 3-drop in your deck? That is the whole point, is to exacerbate the fact that Days and Wasteland are broken, right? We want to be playing everything underneath Days and Wasteland. So anything that can chunk them on the cheap while they're still trying to develop, right? Like anytime a deck gets out of development, they're going to be better against Delver, right? And the whole reason that Expressive Iteration is getting so much attention is that normally you would beat Delver by surviving development. If you can survive the early game and develop, you would beat Delver. And the whole reason that everybody's on Expressive Iteration's dick about being too powerful is because it gives Delver access to beat you even after you've developed. And that is, that feels obnoxious because it's different from what, you know, any other time that Delver's been powerful. Similar to Renin 6. When Renin 6 was around, Delver could still beat you after you've developed. And that felt bad. But like that whole thing is like, the whole point of Delver is to mess you up in development. And if you have a card that doesn't either offset the disadvantage the way that Renin 6 and EI do, which is be able to beat you after you develop, or further beat you up in development, then why are we even talking about it? And that's what I mean, right? So it's like, in my mind, if somebody's like, well, why don't we play Maddening Hex in the main? It's like, well, against certain matchups, that's going to be, that makes sense to me. Once they've developed and then they want to start interacting with you, they're going to get punished for that. That makes sense. If somebody's like, why don't we play Court of Cunning? I'd be like, what are you talking about? Why would we ever want to be in that space? You know what I mean? Similar, if somebody plays, like, we want to play Stifle. That makes sense. Right, I want to stop you in development. That
I love
with the shell that we're
I mean,
talking
I love
about.
To play Stifle. Yeah, of
you
course.
Know what I'm talking about? So
yeah, a good spot to call it. Again, please like and subscribe. Tell us what your favorite budget decks are, because I right now this is something I think that Phil and I are kind of hot on, and it's a great way for to one get people into the format, and two to like kind of expand on the number of decks you own. So if you have like a suggestion for like a budget list, or if you have a budget list that you want to share, even better, type below. You can hit us up on Discord. The Discord's below. Again, you and Francis. We'll be getting cards coming up, and I actually am still waiting on a address from the guy who won last week. If that person does not hit us up, I will put his card into next week's episode as well. And then what else? What's the other thing I'm missing here? Moxfield, check it out. Check out Moxfield and
merch. Buy our merch.
Buy
do
our
stuff
merch
with the
buy
things.
Our merch.
The Patreon.
The what
it
do,
go
the
on
what
the Patreon.
Do merch. Do get the side events end boss merch. Get the Eternal Dirtle shirt. You know, it's all there. You get Eternal Dirtle's dog playmat for like your dog's
food. Do the stuff.
Come on,
do
man.
All the things with the stuff. Do the stuff, buy the stuff, and support the stuff, and Patreon.
Yeah. I also
stuff
wanted to,
and
the other thing I want to talk about actually is, hey, everybody who watched the last episode, the Unbanned episode, everyone who commented on Reddit, everyone who commented on our YouTube channel, thanks so much, man. That was awesome. That's been our best episode so far, and I love doing that like once a year, going back and looking at the ban list, and it's a much different feel than looking at like cards we want banned, right? Like, it's almost a more positive thing, you know?
It feels that way, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But anyhow, I think that's it for us this week. Phil, catch you next week.
Deuces.
Ugh, you're a monster.
Hi, I'm Force of Phil. I can mill all your cards and steal. Cast a drill. Copy you 10 times like I'm a silver quill. Shadrix thinks he knows me. Elder dragons get so lonely. All his high fantasies show me whimsical ways that we're homies. But he hasn't found out that there's a bounty around all of the ink that's abound. If I jab a pin in his mouth and then I let him bleed out and wear his skin like a crown, peer into the abyss of the monarchy that's now bound into my arteries. Part of me feels like a cross between artistry and a plot to peel strawberries. Fruits of my labor are honestly harboring hate for the modesty I inflate as a posturing, like I'm not a shapeshifter, imposter, and evil who's obviously a
monster. We're like evil twins cause we only copy monsters. Guns are fucking dumb but you're still up in our crosshairs. We don't miss our triggers like some chalice playing fraudsters. They're not in our league, while we're winning they all drop it. Send us to the pros where we'll gobble up some sponsors. Copying their clothes, UnZD becomes a cosplayer, cozied up in robes that can only fit us monsters. Call us monsters.
If I'm Fisher, I'm boggling. If I'm Urza, I'm comboing. If I'm Karn, I'll be wishing. It's them and Bridge that be stopping them. Look like Emily, I'm locking them. In the red zone, they hot-headed. Echoing eons like Erebos. Whip up a dead secret grab them. Secret lair them like cake. Baked on a vampire steak. Flaked with the blood of a dragon that's been bleeding for days. Encased in the stench of a library. Exchange our hopes with anxiety. Think of the throat like you're violently trying to boast a new dynasty as a
monster. We're like evil twins because we only copy monsters. Guns are fucking dumb, but you're still up in our crosshair. We don't miss our triggers like them chalice playing fraudsters. They're not in our league. While we're winning, they all drop it. Send us to the pros where we gobble up them sponsors. Copying their clothes, UnZD becomes a cosplayer. Cozied up in robes that can only fit us monsters. Call us monsters.
I'm like Dogma's son, so you can all now call me Crick. I'll forex your face as if a mellish norning gifts I'm given to the living, swimming in stormy conditions for a distance that if you counted in minutes, time would have to walk to finish. And run the risk of slipping on the sticky liquid exhibited in their ribs and requisite a physician to extinguish their injured position with exquisite stitches, sifting lipids through many incisions, pitted in divots and slither wispy fringes between ligaments, squishing blistered withered bits of Renin 6 in a syringe and pins to the stiffness of a strix that's stripped and nipped betwixt the tree of perdition and the algorithmic indifference of tennis. Vizier Quandrix, who wanted Shadrix to listen to his opinion that his lack of precision was the linguistic equivalent of the desperate rip of a Machian fiction written in hieroglyphic inscriptions by a strange and vicious villain, twisted as a wiki, tricking, sickening, sadistic
monster.
Slaughtered your alma mater, valedictorian charters, an auditorium of otters and lobsters bothered by trauma, cauterized by the gore of their fathers, who dropped them for a whore and a dollar, who's glorified only Killers killing it, willing and chilling a billion civilians and grilling their children like chicken that's thickened with fixins and mixed in with pickles and skittles that sketch with some nibble and quibble and lick up the drizzle of simple yet sinful spittle that trickles from the tip of this frivol and shriveled bristles that signal your skin to frill and prickle like a visceral
monster. We're like evil twins cause we only copy monsters. Guns are fucking dumb but you're still up in our crosshairs. We don't miss our triggers like the chalice play fraudsters. They're not in our league while we win and they all drop this. Send us to the pros where we gobble up the sponsors. Copy and they close on ZD becomes a cosplay. Cozied up in robes that can only fit us monsters. Call us monsters.